I'd like a bowl of hot alphabet soup.
Hi, my name is Hayden, and I have a new show on CFRC called Alphabet Soup.
A bowl of hot?
Make sure it's hot.
Alphabet Soup is a musical variety show that's live every Tuesday from 10 to 11 a.m.
Make sure it's hot.
Right.
Okay, sir. Coming right up.
Tune in to hear something classic or something fresh. Tuesdays at 10 a.m. on CFRC.
Hey, Charlie, table 26 wants a hot alphabet soup.
Broadcasting 24/7, 365, you're listening to 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Kingston's only campus community radio station. Tune in for the best local programming.
Good evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, Isabella Garrido, and Joseph Guido. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. The Oak Stabilization Program, administered by Addiction and Mental Health Services, KFLNA, will officially move into its new permanent location at 206 Concession Street in January 2025. The Oak Stabilization Program has been located at a motel in Kingston's West End for the past 3 years. The newly renovated 18-bed facility includes private bathrooms and communal kitchen, dining, and lounge areas. With daily staff programming and individual case managers, the program allows participants to live in a safe and secure environment while they participate in mental health or substance abuse treatment. 206 Concession Street is one of 3 projects funded by the city and the federal government through the Rapid Housing Initiative that recently opened. Jane Hartley, Director of Housing and Social Services with the city, sat down with CFRC to speak to the city's involvement in this project and efforts to provide more transitional housing. This was a big collaborative effort. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about the cross-agency approach that made this possible and how the city has been involved.
Certainly. This has been a cross-agency initiative. The city has been working with addictions and mental health support for a number of years on a number of different initiatives. This project, really, it was with support from the CMHC, Canadian Mortgage and Housing Corporation, through their Rapid Housing Initiative, Round 3, as well as the city contribution with council endorsement that allowed this opportunity to move forward to create this amazing space that can support 18 individuals, you know, working through challenges with mental health and addiction. So the funding was approved in 2023, construction started and a renovation started in 2024, and we were really happy to have our ribbon cutting earlier this week.
Yeah, and how has this move contributed to the city's goals? What's the scale of the impact this project and the 2 other Rapid Housing Initiative projects this fall winter season have had?
You know, it's really about, we can't do it alone, the city, and with senior levels of government funding and the city commitment to funding, it's really supporting on many different levels those, you know, most vulnerable individuals in our community. The Habitat was our first ribbon cutting a while back. That was the one initiative that was under the Rapid Housing Initiative. That was, you know, $484,000 that created 8 tiny homes and are fully rented up. And that was, you know, that's really helped to just allow those individuals to, for some, to have the first time a home of their own and a space to where they can afford to, you know, grow and thrive and, you know, help support them with staffing to support them on their journey to hopefully independent housing. And that's where the staff there are really committed to working, Habitat for Humanity and their staff supporting those individuals. The second one was this, you know, AMHS collaboration with the city to create this wonderful 18-bed site. We received funding through CMHC, and then the city contributed over $1 million to support the renovation. So it's, again, this is a opportunity for those individuals, and it was amazing at the ribbon cutting. There was a woman that, you know, provided kind of a letter of, you know, what this meant to her. And it's really when you hear those, you know, it's the first chance she's had in a long journey of challenges, and just the excitement and the hope that these opportunities provide. This is a, you know, this is really an opportunity where 18 individuals can come into this site and work towards on their mental health and addiction challenges with the guidance, support, you know, what they need to help them move forward and to live a fulfilling and, you know, happy life. And, you know, often there's so many in our community that do not have that opportunity. And this is the start, you know, for us to continue to do more work and working with AMHS on that.
Sean Allen, program manager with the Oak Stabilization Program, also sat down for an interview with CFRC about the new space. Oak Stabilization Program has been located at a motel in the West End for the past 3 years. I was wondering if you could dive into what the circumstances were before and how this new location is going to add to the program.
For sure. So about 3 years ago, Addiction Mental Health Services, KFLA, recognized the growing need to support folks in our community who are homeless and challenges with substance use. And so real quick, they had to get something going. And so the motel was sort of the best option at that time. But as you can imagine, it doesn't quite serve all of our needs. So this new building is quite fantastic, actually. It has a large kitchen that will be able to run some life skills groups, some cooking groups, come together to share meals. We have spaces for community partners if they need to meet with shared clients as well. So that is something different than what we have at the motel. We also don't have a kitchen at the motel. So all of that is new and different for us. And it's a new, fresh building retrofitted just for us. So it also is updated and, you know, gives some dignity around their recovery journey.
And getting into the details here, I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about the Oak Stabilization Program administered by AMHS.
Yeah, so it's an 18-bed addiction recovery program. And so folks who come to us are struggling mainly with addiction, but also some mental health. They also are, prior to coming to us, homeless or precariously housed, and have a desire to make some changes in their life towards recovery. There's programming each day, and each individual has a case manager designated to them, but there's a team approach in serving all clients. That's kind of it.
And you mentioned this is an 18-bed facility. Is that the same capacity as you had before, or is that new as well?
It is the same capacity as we had before. So the difference is that we're all in one spot, whereas before we were we're all kind of isolated in our own rooms, and three of our 18 rooms were at the front of the building and the rest were at the back of the motel. And this way we're all located in one spot, even though each individual has their own room. It's different than being sort of in a row of rooms in a motel.
Recent strike votes from Queen's University workers signal possible labor disruptions in the new year. A release from QP earlier this week confirmed that across three Kingston groups, 96% of members voted in favor of strike action. This includes trades, custodial and food service workers, educational and laboratory technical staff, and library technicians. According to the release, most of these Queen's workers have seen their wages fall below inflation by 11 to 14% in recent years, and many have had to take on second or third jobs to make ends meet. For those in trades, hourly wages are $10 to $15 lower than at other Kingston employers. QP254 President Marie Edwards, representing technicians, spoke to the current state of negotiations in an interview with CFRC. What have you been experiencing so far, and what are you hearing from your fellow Queen's workers? Where is the university falling short here?
The biggest problem among our members right now is wages. The constraint of 1% wage increase over the last 3 years has impacted the members greatly, especially considering how inflation has driven the prices of everything up. So if you look at the buying power, we've gone down in the last number of years by roughly 10% of buying power. So members are having a hard time putting money away to save. Some are having difficulty making ends meet with rent. We have a fairly broad range of salary. Some of them are having difficulty with food. They're experiencing food insecurity.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could speak to the circumstances and the state of negotiations that's brought us here, where Queen's workers are ready to strike in the new year.
They're feeling that the university is not listening when it comes to compensation. There was a request to have a wage opener clause in the last collective agreement because, you know, we knew that the wage constraint did come down from government. The university denied our request for this. And we're concerned that they're going to come into it looking for a similar increase that they've given us in the last number of years. So in the last 10 years, our wage increases have been an average of 1.25.
While it is anticipated that wage negotiations will be difficult, Edwards did report progress in non-wage related bargaining, which took place just prior to the interview. You did mention that you just came back from bargaining with non-wage related issues. How did that go?
That went very well. There's been good discussion on the language and the changes. Some of the changes were to align the collective agreement with language from labor laws, that kind of thing. Some of them were also to recognize, for instance, a recognition of a family member may mean different things to different groups.
When asked for comment by CFRC, the university simply responded, stating they are engaged in separate talks with several unions, and they remain committed to reaching negotiated agreements that are capable of being ratified by the parties involved. While workers are ready to strike, Edwards has hope an agreement will be reached before it comes to that. The latest update from Queen's, since it was released that QB workers are ready to strike, was simply that you're still in negotiations. Do you foresee any change in circumstances before the new year that would prevent a strike?
We're all working towards reaching an agreement to avoid a strike. But the workers want to be in a position where they can, if they're going to strike, we want to strike in a manner where it will have the most impact so that we can get it dealt with and finished as quickly as possible. Because really, everyone wants to be back at work.
And do we have any ideas on timeline?
We have not been offered any monetary proposals at this time. The university has not given us any idea when we might be expecting those. We do have a number of bargaining dates scheduled for January, towards the end of January, the 24th, 28th, and 31st. So I'm hoping that there will be some monetary proposals on the table at that time.
In another message directly from the city, this is how the City of Kingston and Utilities Kingston services and facilities will be affected by the holidays. As for green bin garbage and recycling, there is no collection on December 25th and 26th. Collection will occur 2 days after your regularly scheduled collection. There is also no collection on January 1st, and collection will occur the day after your regularly scheduled collection. The Kingston Area Recycling Center will be open on December 24th from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. and closed on December 25th, 26th, and January 1st. Real Christmas trees, ornaments, and tinsel removed can be dropped off for free at the Kingston Area Recycling Center, 196 Lappin's Lane. As for the transit schedule, Christmas Eve, December 24th, will be a regular weekday service. There will be no service on Christmas Day, December 25th. Boxing Day, December 26th, will be Sunday service, except Route 18, which will operate on its regular weekday schedule. On December 31st, New Year's Eve, everyone can ride for free at any time on all routes. Transit will operate on a regular weekday schedule. The following routes will be running on extended service as late as 3 a.m. routes 1, 2, 7, and 3132, and Express 501 502, 601 602, and 701 702. On New Year's Day, January 1st, there will be no service. Queen's University routes will not run during the holiday break. Route 20 service will be paused December 21st to January 8th, and Route 17 service will be paused December 22nd to January 8th. As for municipal offices and facilities, administrative offices, including housing and social services on Montreal Street, will be closed December 24th to 26th and January 1st. Provincial Offences Court at 362 Montreal Street will be open on December 24th from 8:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. and closed December 25th, 26th, and January 1st. Utilities Kingston and Kingston Hydro are open on December 24th and 31st from 8 a.m. until noon and closed on December 25th and 26th and January 1st. For a utility emergency, you can call their emergency line at 613-546-1181. The Kingston Frontenac Public Library will be closed on December 24th to 26th and December 31st to January 1st. The Invista Fitness Center and Ice Pads on December 24th, all programming, fitness center, and the front desk will close at 2 p.m. The center will also be closed on December 25th, 26th, and January 1st. New Year's Eve, December 31st, all programming and the fitness center will close at 2 p.m. to make way for a New Year's Eve event. The Artillery Park Aquatic Center on December 24th and 31st, the front desk and building will close at 2 p.m. and it will be closed on December 25th, 26th, and January 1st. The Rideau Heights Community Center and Kingston East Community Center will both be closed on December 24th, 25th, 26th, 31st, and January 1st. The Market Wing Cultural Space will be closed December 22nd to January 2nd. And finally, the Tet Center will be closed December 24th to January 2nd. Once again, that was an overview of how the holidays are going to affect the city and Utilities Kingston services. Looking forward to 2025, change is often the hallmark of a new calendar year. For Kingston Transit, the new year will bring enhanced service and more frequent trips beginning Monday, January 6, 2025. New early morning and late night trips to employment areas will offer more convenient options for commuters to get to and from work. Transit customers can also take advantage of more trips during busy times, including more routes with 15-minute or better service, to more easily get to where they need to go. Christopher Norris, General Manager of Kingston Transit, states, quote, "We're building on the updates made in September to ensure our system is frequent, accessible, reliable, and available for customers to easily travel. Enhancing our network frequency and responding to the changing travel needs of our customers is an essential part of our work," end quote. Customers can explore the new schedules and maps at kingstontransit.ca. By clicking an individual route and selecting the January 6th button, you can stay connected to Kingston Transit through the Transit app on Android or iPhone. That wraps up your headlines for this evening. Next up is Jesse Bell with your CFRC Sports Desk.
This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. We start with Monday, December 30th. Unseasonably warm, daytime high of 6 degrees with a 60% chance of precipitation. Tuesday, December 31st, New Year's Eve, daytime high of 4 degrees and it will be cloudy. Wednesday, January 1st, 2025, daytime high of 3 degrees but a 60% chance of precipitation, rain showers with some flurries mixed in there. Thursday, January 2nd, daytime high of 0 degrees with a 40% chance of flurries. Friday, January 3rd, we are going to see a daytime high of minus 4 dropping down to minus 8 overnight. Saturday, January 4th is going to be the coldest day of 2025 thus far with a daytime high of minus 7 dropping to minus 11 overnight. Sunday, January 5th, we're going to see a daytime high of minus 5 with an overnight low of minus 7. And then Monday, January 6th, 2025, daytime high of minus 3, overnight low of minus 9. This is Jesse Bell with CFRC's weekly traffic report for the Kingston area. Princess 2, 486 Albert Street is closed until December 31st to accommodate construction and staging at 484 Albert Street. King Street, tragically hip way to Place d'Armes, is closed January 4th, 6 p.m. to January 6th, 4 a.m. for event-related parking and storage at Slush Puppy Place. Market Street, Kingdo, Ontario, is closed from January 4th, 12 p.m. to 4 p.m. for the Mater's New Year's celebration. University Avenue, Union de Stewart, is closed December 27th from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. for a crane to remove an HVAC unit. Some other delays to be aware of. Aberdeen Street, Johnson to Earl, expect delays and closures along Aberdeen for a contractor to complete road and sewer reconstruction. Collins Bay Road, Prince Charles slash Edwin to Princess, expect delays while a contractor completes phase two of the Princess and Collins Bay active transportation improvements. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water mains for Utility Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Gardner's Road, Centennial and Creekford, expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence, expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Sir John A. MacDonald Boulevard at Elmwood, expect delays while a contractor upgrades the intersection at Sir John A. MacDonald Boulevard and Elmwood Street, including the replacement of street lighting, new traffic lights, replacement of asphalt on roadways, and a new multi-use pathway south of the intersection towards Bath Road.
This is your event calendar for the week. If you have an event you would like covered, feel free to reach out via cfrc.ca. On December 30th, Coffee and Connection, Mental Health Support from 10 p.m. to 11:30 p.m. A safe place to relax, connect, and create. Event located at 552 Princess Street every Monday. Also on December 30th is the Fast Food Cooking Group from 2:30 p.m. to 4:30 p.m. Participants create quick recipes using few ingredients, which are healthy and nourishing. Registration required. To register, email Kate, K-A-T-E-E, at kchc.ca. On December 30th, the West End Run Club, Loggers and Joggers, 5:25 p.m. till 7 p.m., will be running. This event will be taking place at the Fine Balance Brewing Company. Join Runner's Choice for their free weekly run groups. All ages and paces are welcome. If you're a new runner, call Runner's Choice at 613-542-2410. Groups are canceled in unsafe weather conditions. Dress accordingly for current weather conditions and wear something reflective. December 31st at 8:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. is the Kingston Public Market. It's the oldest market in Ontario and has been providing food and a sense of community to residents of Kingston since 1801. The market is located in Kingston's historic downtown, right behind City Hall. December 31st, Spearhead Brewing Weekly Board Game Night from 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. Head over to Spearhead Brewing, 675 Development Drive, for an unbeatable night of board games, delicious tacos, and craft beer. From December 31st, live country music at The Buckle from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. Courtney Kane will be performing on stage from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. January 1st is the Fresh Food Market pop-up from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. Fresh Food Market pop-up is here to help keep your belly full without emptying your wallet. We're bringing fresh, affordable produce and chef-created gourmet healthy options to Kingston and the surrounding areas every week. This event will take place at Rideau Heights Community Center. Visit freshfoodmarket.ca for more info. January 1st, also, Frank Ryan will be performing live at Musiki Cafe from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. On January 2nd, the Kingston Public Market is open from 8:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. It's the oldest market in Ontario and has been providing food and a sense of community to residents of Kingston since 1801. The market is located in Kingston's historic downtown, right behind City Hall. On January 2nd, Royal Jam Open Mic Night takes place every Thursday night starting at 9 p.m. and ending at 11:55 p.m. at the Blue Martini. On January 3rd is the Fresh Food Market pop-up from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. Also on January 3rd, Christopher Jackson live at Blue Martini from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. This event includes free cover with upbeat rock and old country songs by Christopher Jackson and his band every Friday night. Pay what you can to the musicians. On January 3rd, country karaoke at The Buckle from 9 p.m. to midnight. January 4th is live music for all ages, 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. Musiki Cafe hosts live music every night from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. The lineup changes weekly. Follow Musiki Cafe on Instagram to see who's performing this week. January 5th is the Memorial Center Farmers Market, open from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Many local farmers are represented here, as well as soap and candle makers and top small-scale designers. You can also find fresh, locally prepared food and dine at our food court. Whatever your local needs, the Memorial Center's Farmers Market is always here to help you. On January 5th, Afternoons with Savannah from 4:30 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. Come join Savannah Shea at Musiki Cafe. She is a Kingston-based singer, writer, and multi-instrumentalist, with her songs being focused on contemplation, love, the miracle of Mother Nature, and the internal conflicts of being human. On January 5th, Christmas party for singles over 30, 6 p.m. to 11 p.m. Dinner is still being decided on this event, but it will start at 6 p.m., followed by a trip to Splitsville for some bowling. Email Sarah Witwick at gmail.com for more details. That's Sarah, W-I-T-I-U-K, at gmail.com. January 5th, there's a concert at the Grand Theater, News of the World by Queen Live. This is an authentic recreation of the actual Queen album, note for note, cut for cut, then a brief intermission followed by a greatest hit set. Buy tickets now at the Kingston Grand Theater website. And that concludes the event for this week. If you have an event you would like covered, feel free to reach out via cfrc.ca.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What Will I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present Nolan Hubbard's latest single, I Won't Lie, released November 22nd from his second EP and debut release under his new indie label, Kingsville Records. This five-track collection captures the artist's journey through self-discovery and relationships in his early 20s, showing a growth from his 2017 debut, Luminosity. Now 28, Hubbard describes this EP as the culmination of his evolving sound, blending soulful harmony, layered fingerstyle guitar, and genre-bending instrumentation. While rooted in pop folk, the record explores fresh influences like alternative, reggae, hip-hop, and country, balancing creative freedom with a clear pop sensibility. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visitkingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream I Won't Lie on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
I'm doing fine. Got messed up again. Stop seeing all my friends. I was stuck in my head, but the way someone said I look like a mess. Now I know what they meant. Man, I just need some rest. Probably meant me the best. Yeah. I've been on stupid long. You don't gotta worry what I'm working on. Those days are gone. Can't hear anybody tell me wrong. Think I just need a break. Put me on a boat in a big old lake. Can't help myself, I'm doing fine. Yeah, I'm feeling good, no, I won't lie. I got the recipe. Wherever I'm cooking is a place to be. Not like obsessively, we'll have a good time on any street. But if you wanna ride with me, gotta find time for the comedy. Have the kind of attitude, a little bit of authenticity. Can't help myself, I'm doing fine. Yeah, I'm feeling good, no, I won't lie.
Friday evenings at 6 p.m. here on CFRC. Listen to Saltwater Music, a show covering all musical genres from the East Coast of Canada. Celtic, of course, but also rock, jazz, blues, folk, and a lot more. I'm your host, Rob Carnell. Tune in to Saltwater Music Friday evening from 6 to 8 here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Or you can catch us on the web at www.cfrc.ca. And for our listeners out east, that's 7 p.m. Atlantic and 7:30 Newfoundland.
Tune in Sundays at 11 p.m. for Orchestral Maneuvers After Dark with me, DJ Squared. Each episode features a great mix of new and vintage, Canadian and international, new wave, punk, post-punk, garage rock, pop, electronica, ambient, and even the occasional remix. Sweet beats are in store for all to enjoy. Join in the fun, OMD, every Sunday at 11 right here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
This is CFRC 101.9 FM, your campus and community radio station, broadcast from the basement of Caruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston. You can also hear this program locally on Cogeco Cable, channel 282, and is streamed online at cfrc.ca.
Welcome to Biotech Beat. This is your host, Chris Ron. Today we will hear a talk on the topic, Sugar, No Ordinary Commodity, A Second Look by Dr. Robert Lustig, Professor of Pediatrics, University of California. This program was produced and distributed by AncestralFoundation.org. Before that, here are a few messages.
Tree Canada's National Greening Program is planting seedlings across five regions of the country: BC, the Prairies, Ontario, Quebec, and the Atlantic. They plant in areas that are in need of reforestation or afforestation across Canada. Tree Canada selects sites where appropriate native species will be planted to make sure that natural forests come back to life. To learn more or to get involved, go to treecanada.ca.
I faced it. I have Alzheimer's disease.
My diagnosis has let me get on with my life my way.
The more we learned about my grandfather's dementia, the more we could face the future and make plans.
My husband, Tom, and I spoke to our doctor right away.
I have Alzheimer's, but it doesn't have me.
I faced it.
So can you.
For more information about early diagnosis, visit alzheimer.ca.
CFRC is active on every social media platform. Check us out at CFRC Radio on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. And on Twitter at CFRC.
Last year at this meeting, I talked about the science and the evolutionary biology of sugar and how it ultimately affects us in several different ways, particularly in terms of the concentration that we are currently consuming in terms of dose. And, you know, from various standpoints, from the liver insulin resistance standpoint, from the hedonic standpoint. Ultimately, the science should drive policy, but the politics get in the way. But what we're going to do today is we're going to basically extrapolate that logic from the science to what policy considerations we might put into practice today. Some of you, I'm sure, read the article in Nature that's here on the right. Some of you, I know, have blogged about it, some of you quite negatively. And I'm here today to try to defend that position in terms of what societal intervention can or should do in terms of our current sugar pandemic and why it's so important. Now, in 2003, Thomas Baber and colleagues who worked with the World Health Organization established these four criteria for societal intervention of any given substance. Unavoidability, that you can't get rid of it. Number two, toxicity. Number three, abuse. And number four, most importantly, negative impact on society. Certainly, alcohol and tobacco satisfy those four criteria. And so we treat those two substances very differently than we do virtually any other substance. We have learned to, quote, peacefully coexist with them, but through legislation, through changes in society that ultimately reduce total consumption, and they have had very beneficial health effects. No one can argue with the success of tobacco and alcohol legislation and regulation. But let's talk about how sugar might work within those four confines, purely on a scientific and logical basis right now. First, unavoidability. Of course, we're all eating more. Everybody will tell you that the reason for obesity is we eat too much and we exercise too little. Right? Wrong. Well, you know, we're eating more of everything. Right? Wrong. We're not eating more of everything. We're eating more, certainly here, but we're not eating more fat. We've been told to reduce our consumption of fat from 40 to 30%. Here are the secular trends in specific food intake, and here are the fats. Milk way down, meat and cheese about the same. Desserts, you know, milk desserts about the same. Bottom line, we're not eating more fat. And as you can see here from the calories from fat going from 40 to 30% over the past 30 years because of the ADA, the AMA, the USDA recommendations of the early 1980s based on the McGovern Commission, our obesity and metabolic syndrome prevalence has gone through the roof. No, it's carbohydrate that we're eating more of. And obviously I'm speaking, you know, that's like bringing coals to Newcastle here. Everybody's part of the choir. So here are the secular trends in carbohydrate intake all through the roof. We are not eating more, we are eating more carbohydrate. And what carbohydrate? Well, in particular, beverages, right? 41% increase in soft drinks, 35% increase in fruit drinks, fruitades, et cetera. And that stuff here in America is this stuff, high fructose corn syrup, where we are currently consuming 63 pounds per person per year on average. But notice the current users are only the US, Canada, Japan, and very limited exposure in parts of Europe. Yet, the entire world has exactly the same disease as we do, and they're catching up. There is no high fructose corn syrup in Australia. They are the third most obese society on the face of the earth, and they have all the same diseases we do. So what is this stuff? Well, as you know, high fructose corn syrup is up on top. One molecule of glucose, one molecule of fructose, you know, give or take, you know, 55%, 45%. And down on the bottom is sucrose, one molecule of glucose, one molecule of fructose, joined by an O-glycosidic linkage, which is cleaved by the enzyme sucrase in about a nanosecond. Bottom line, biologically, chemically, these are equivalent. And all of the studies that pit high fructose corn syrup against sucrose show no different effects. All the same, all bad. That's the problem. Doesn't matter which one it is. And the whole world has shown this. Here's our secular trend in fructose consumption. Our ancestors getting fruits and vegetables out of the ground with the occasional honey got to about 15 grams of fructose a day. Prior to World War II, with the nascent candy and soft drink industries in America, we got up to about 20 grams a day. By 1977, before the glut of high fructose corn syrup in America, we got up to 37 grams a day, which was 8% of our total caloric intake. By 1994, we were up to 55 grams, or 10% of our total caloric intake. And currently, adolescents average 75 grams a day, which is 12% of total caloric intake. So double that for sugar, because it's glucose, fructose, right? So that's 25%. And 25% of adolescents today in America consume 100 grams of fructose per day. Double that for sugar, that's 200 grams. Multiply by 4.1 calories per gram. That means 840 calories a day in sugar, which is more than 40% of total caloric intake. So we are not just eating more. This is what we're eating more of. And as you know, cross-sectional and longitudinal studies correlating sugar consumption with energy intake, body weight, milk and calcium intake, adequate nutrition, all show significant negative effects in all directions. This disclaimer is that those studies that are funded by the beverages industry show much less of an effect. Wonder why. If you look at mechanistic studies where you actually take the stuff away, so this is the fizzy drink study from James et al., you'll notice that the intervention schools maintain their prevalence of obesity over a course of a year of soft drink restriction, whereas the control schools continue to show increased prevalence. Now, this is where things get a little contentious. Everyone in this room has a pet diet. Some of you are making money off your pet diet. I'm not making money off anything, all right? But the bottom line is, they all share two things in common. Anybody know what the two things are? Low sugar, high fiber. And you know what we call low sugar, high fiber diets? Real food. Ultimately, that's what we're really talking about here is food processing. Not specifically sugar, not specifically high carb. We're talking about real food, because if you ate real food, you would get a low sugar, high fiber diet. The fiber would mitigate the carbohydrate, as we know occurs in terms of the glucose rise, therefore the insulin rise, keeping insulin down. Real food's the story. But in the 1980s, we went on the low fat craze due to the AMA, AHA, and USDA recommendations. The point is that the content of low fat home-cooked food can be controlled. You can decide what goes into the food that you make at home. But low-fat processed food is a whole other story because it tastes like cardboard. And palatability equals sales. And the food industry knew that. So when they were remanded to reduce the amount of fat in the diet, they had to do something. What'd they do? Up the carbohydrates, specifically the sugar, either with HFCS or sucrose. An example, of course, is Snackwells. 2 grams of fat down, 13 grams of carbohydrate up, 4 of which were sugar. So I would pose to you, which was worse, the sugar or the fat? I think you know the answer. Here's my daughter, when she was in second grade, bringing milk cartons home for me from the San Francisco Unified School District and said, "Dad, you're not gonna believe this. Over here is Berkeley Farms 1% low-fat milk, 130 calories, was it, 14 grams of sugar, which is lactose, which is not a problem because the galactose gets converted to glucose in the liver. And here's Berkeley Farms 1% chocolate milk. 190 calories, 60 calories more, 29 grams of sugar, all high fructose corn syrup. So when you drink a glass of chocolate milk in school, that's a glass of milk plus a half a glass of orange juice. And the question is that okay? This is, again, highly contentious, but I would pose to you that evolution for foodstuffs, you have one form of energy storage or the other. For meat and for other fatty fruits, for instance, avocado, coconut, olives, you have fat. And for other things that come out of the ground, you have carbohydrate. But you don't usually have both. Only sugar, only sucrose, because the fructose gets converted to fat in the liver through de novo lipogenesis. And of course, the glucose is carbohydrate, is both. When glycogen storage stores are full, that's when de novo lipogenesis occurs. And that's the liver's way of exporting extra energy out of the liver so it doesn't get sick. The problem is it gets stuck. It causes liver insulin resistance and fatty liver, which you know, and that starts the cascade of hyperinsulinemia, insulin resistance, and all the diseases that we know about. And here's the big problem right here. Of the 600,000 food items sold in the US grocery store today, 80% of them are laced with added sugar, very specifically for the food industry's purposes, not for yours. And that's the issue that we're facing today, is you can't eat properly because the food industry won't let you. As far as I'm concerned, we've had our entire food supply adulterated through the addition of fructose for palatability, especially with the decrease in fat, and ostensibly as a browning agent. Well, you all know that that browning that occurs is the Maillard reaction, which is the same thing as hemoglobin A1C. We know that's bad for you, right? Because that causes glycation of proteins, causing them to have decreased flexibility, causing cellular aging. And every time that that Maillard reaction occurs, you release a reactive oxygen species, which has to be quenched by an antioxidant. And if you're antioxidant deficient, which processed food is, you get cell death, you get human death. In addition, the removal of fiber, ostensibly for shelf life, right? And also for freezing, because you can't freeze fiber. Go home, take an orange, put it in your freezer overnight, take it out, put it out on the table and let it thaw, try to eat it, see what you get. What do you get? Mush. Why do you get mush? Because the ice crystals macerate the cell wall of the plant so that when you thaw it, all the water rushes in, turns it to mush. Food industry knows that. So what do you do? Squeeze it and freeze it, lasts forever, brings prices down, okay? Because there's no depreciation. So good for your pocketbook, good for the food industry, bad for your health, big time. And of course, substitution of trans fats, but we know that, so we're getting rid of those. Okay, now to toxicity, and this is where the seven slides will come in. First of all, here are the 10 most obese states in the United States. No surprise to anybody. Here are the 10 laziest states. What's going on over there in Nevada? I guess you can only burn so much energy going like this, and now you just have to go like this, right? Okay, well, here are the 10 most unhappy states. No surprise. Well, here's the adult diabetes rate. Here's the adult heart disease rate. Again, no surprise. And finally, here's soda per capita consumption. What do you see? All right, now, everyone will say, wait a second, that's correlation, not causation. Indeed it is. Why? Because those are poor states, and you know they don't have any money to buy decent food, et cetera, and they're pretty unhappy, so what do you think they do? They drown their sorrows in a Coca-Cola. Because after all, if you watch the advertisement, Coca-Cola will tell you, if you open a bottle of Coke, you open happiness. Indeed, right. Here's the problem is it's not just America, it's the whole world. Because here's the worldwide per capita supply of sugar. This was in the Nature article. And we know from the American Heart Association missive from 2009 that we're not to consume more than 150 to 200 calories of sugar per day for cardiovascular health. And you can see how many countries are above that threshold, virtually all of them. And world sugar consumption has tripled over the past 50 years. Notice Brazil, highest per capita consumption. Why? Because they're an exporter, now they're a consumer because they can afford it. And they now have the highest increase in prevalence of type 2 diabetes in the world. Not the highest prevalence, that is reserved for Saudi Arabia and Malaysia. Saudi Arabia and Malaysia, how do they do this? No alcohol. What they got? Soft drinks like they're going out of style. Why? Because the water supply sucks, right? Okay. You know who does the water purification for most countries? Coca-Cola, right? Yeah. Okay. And you know, if you don't have any alcohol, you got to get your pleasure somewhere. What do these five pictures have in common? They're all brown. That's the Maillard reaction, okay? It's the non-enzymatic glycation or fructosylation. Either way, it's why you put barbecue sauce on your meat. So bottom line is you can slow roast your meat for 1 hour at 375 degrees, or you can slow roast your meat at 98.6 degrees for 75 years. You get the same thing, okay? That's aging right there. And I'll show that to you because here's rib cartilage as a function of age. There's newborn rib cartilage and there's 88-year-old rib cartilage. You're all browning even as we speak, okay? Hey, if you had an orange juice at breakfast, you're browning faster. And here's the data that shows it. This is in vitro data showing the rate of glucose binding to proteins there on the left versus fructose. And this is 7 times faster. You can see the rate there. And the number of carbonyls, which are the reactive oxygen species produced, are 100 times greater. Now, this is in vitro, but it's true in vivo as well. This is correlational data, but we actually have mechanistic data in animals showing that the rate of steatosis, the great stage of fibrosis, correlate with fructose consumption in a liver clinic in Duke. And this is rate of inflammation, rate of ballooning, same thing. So basically, your liver gets sick when you consume sugar. Now, abuse. Everybody seems to know that sugar's addictive, except, of course, the scientists. And I had a big argument with somebody at the American Society of Nutrition back in April over this same issue. Okay, the question is sugar actually addictive? Anybody see the 60 Minutes piece? It just got replayed on Sunday night. Okay, Eric Stice thinks sugar's addictive, and he's looking at fMRIs in the brain. And here's the data. This is showing dopamine D2 receptors in red in a control brain versus a cocaine brain. You can see the downregulation of D2 receptors. That's tolerance. That's the neuroimaging correlate of tolerance. And if you have tolerance plus withdrawal, you have addiction. And that's what we see in patients who try to come off sugar is they feel lousy. Here's a control brain, here's an obese brain showing the same effect. Downregulation of D2 receptors. Because obese people, because they don't get the same level of reward for each molecule of energy that they consume, they have to eat more to get there. And so that's called tolerance. So is there really such a thing as sugar addiction? Well, we have to look for similarities to other drugs of dependence. So like nicotine, morphine, amphetamine, cocaine. And the one I would suggest is the closest, both metabolically and in terms of commodities, is ethanol, alcohol. And that's what we've done is we've compared fructose to alcohol in our research, in our papers. The criteria for addiction in animals are the following: binging, withdrawal, craving, and cross-sensitization with other drugs of abuse. So in other words, you expose an animal for 3 weeks to one drug of abuse, say amphetamine, and then you hit them with another drug of abuse, say cocaine, that they've never been seen before, and they'll get enhanced locomotion and increased consumption from the second drug, even though they've never seen it before, because the dopamine D2 receptors are the same, no matter which substrate you use. And that includes, by the way, power, money, gambling, etc. Okay. How about humans? Here are the DSM-5 criteria for addiction. So tolerance and withdrawal, that's physiologic. And then this list over here of various things, and if you read through that, it sounds like every obese patient that we take care of. The point is that we have toxic substances that are not abused. For instance, iron, vitamin D, they'll kill you, right? Iron toxicity, vitamin D intoxication. Pseudoephedrine, once it's turned into crystal meth, right? And we have abused substances that are not toxic, like caffeine. And if you take my Starbucks away from me, I will kill you. And nicotine, right? Nicotine's not toxic, right? You can buy it at Walgreens, right? In Nicorette gum. It's the tars in the cigarettes that are toxic. But when you are both toxic and abused, now you have a problem. So that's morphine, heroin, amphetamine, cocaine, ethanol, and I'm just showing you sugar. And the problem is that when you're toxic and abused, educational efforts alone don't reduce consumption. Did Nancy Reagan's Just Say No work? Finally, externalities, a negative impact on society. So societal intervention requires externalities. So if you smoke or drink or take drugs, it's bad for me. Secondhand smoke, car accidents, declining house prices, you know, work productivity, I gotta do your job. How does your obesity affect me? $274 million extra for jet fuel. Yeah. Discomfort on the subway. Sinking of boats due to the weight. 2003, Lake George. The boat was coded for 17 people at 165 pounds. They had 24 people at 190 pounds average, and the boat went over. Okay, no, that's not it. $65 billion reduction in work productivity, 50% increase in absenteeism, 50% increase in health insurance premiums, $150 billion in healthcare resources wasted every year. We could balance the medical budget on that, clearly, and we could probably balance the federal budget on it. Obesity is a threat to national security because 27% of all conscripts are obese and get 4F'd. And the government pays twice. They pay for the food subsidy, and then they pay for the ER visits. Okay, and that, all of that affects you, whether you're obese or not. So this is a public health problem. This is not a personal responsibility problem. And finally, who's winning the war? This is the S&P 500 in blue, compared to the stock price of McDonald's, Coke, and Pepsi over the last 5 years. And there's the economic downturn of 2008. You know, they're doing very well, thank you. And here's Monsanto, Archer Daniels, Midland, Hormel, General Mills, ConAgra, Procter & Gamble, and Kraft, all doing better than the S&P. How come? Because when we have less money, we eat more. Why? Because that's our pleasure, that's our reward, and ultimately, the more pleasure and the more reward, the unhappier we get. Now, there is debate among scientists. There's honest debate, and that's okay, and I'm happy to have that debate. Okay, for instance, here's Luke Tappy's article saying that the science is right, but are we ready for a public health intervention? And we can have that debate. That's why I'm here. And here's Sadaf Farooqi's work from England. You know, she does leptin deficiency, saying, is the addiction model convincing? Okay, so, you know, there's real honest to goodness debate, and I'm happy to have it. However, the American Heart Association has reversed its stance from fat to sugar being the issue. And this is the paper that we published in 2009, recommending reduction in sugar intake from 22 teaspoons a day to 9 for men and 6 for women. So here's the bottom line. Personal responsibility versus public health, the libertarians versus the communitarians. Here are a whole bunch of diseases that were personal responsibility until they became too big, too problematic for society, and ultimately public health had to get involved. Well, sugar and obesity and metabolic syndrome fits that as well. You could add, by the way, teen pregnancy and gun control to this list as well. So the question to pose is, can our toxic environment, which we have created, be changed without government or societal intervention, especially when there are addictive substances involved? There are three methods of societal intervention. I am not endorsing any one of the three, or any of the three for that matter. The only thing I'm endorsing is reduction in consumption, however we can get there. So everybody who says, oh, he's for taxing sugar. No, I'm not. I've never said I was for it. I said, let's put it on the table and discuss it. Okay, that's just a rational academic argument based on the data. So there's taxation, restriction of access, interdiction. No one's proposing interdiction. I am not banning sugar. I'm not suggesting we ban sugar. Okay? Only Michael Bloomberg can do that. I'm suggesting that we have to negotiate a peaceful coexistence with sugar, the same as tobacco and ethanol. Not interdiction, but maybe taxation and restriction of access. We'll see. The point is, you can do public health two ways. You can do targeted prevention. The strengths are individual. It's limited to those affected. That sounds good. Easier to incorporate into medical care, except for one thing. Hasn't worked. Benefit to risk ratio is high, but the weaknesses are big. Medicalization of prevention, that's hard to do. Behavior modification is impossible to do. Cost and feasibility are ridiculously expensive and limited success. How about public health prevention? Here are the strengths. It's radical. It works. It's powerful. Environmental modification. We actually live in a cleaner, safer environment if we take care of these things. Okay? Less antibiotics in the meat if we actually ate real food. Okay, as an example. The limitations are acceptability, especially to the libertarians, feasibility, and finally, also costs. Here's the issue. It's not just the obese. Okay, it's not just the obese who get metabolic syndrome. In fact, 10 people get metabolic syndrome, they're just not obese. They have all the same risk factors and they have the same diseases. Assuming an adult population of 240 million, 30% of which are obese, here's how the math works. 80% of obese people have metabolic dysfunction. That means 20% don't. So you can be fat and fit, and you can be perfectly fine and live a perfectly normal, healthy life, and you're just fat. That's 0.8 times 0.3 times 240 million, that's 57 million people. But 40% of normal weight people have metabolic dysfunction, as demonstrated by their lab tests or their cardiac or diabetes events. So that's 40% times 0.7 times 240 million, that's 67 million people. So ultimately, we're talking about 124 million adults. That's more than half of the US population. So you think you can do that with targeted prevention? Forget it, this is public health. But why is alcohol so relevant? Well, here's the corresponding phenomena for alcohol and sugar. Both are ostensibly nutrients, but aside from energy, they have no health value. Metabolic and CNS pathways are similar. Both legal substances that produce health harms when overused. Little danger from moderate consumption, but the burden of harm falls disproportionately on the low SES groups, and they're the group that can least afford the money to basically take care of their healthcare, and they are the ones who show up in the emergency rooms, and they are the ones who are chewing through all our healthcare dollars. No issue. Socioeconomic status. Now, here are the strategies that have not worked for alcohol, and there's no reason to suspect that they will work for sugar either. Government guidelines have not worked. Public information campaigns have not worked. Warning labels on product packaging have not worked. School-based education programs have not worked. And ultimately, most recently, menu labeling has not worked. I'll show you the menu labeling. So this was the historical cross-sectional study that was done in New York City when they instituted, the Department of Health instituted their menu labeling plan. So they looked at lunchtime purchases at several fast food chains in 2007, 2009, before and after. The mean calories did not change. Three major chains showed very small decreases. 15% of the respondents reported using the calorie information. Those who used it consumed 106 calories less. Problem is, it was only 15%. And that's about right, because about 15% of the US population actually has a brain. How about for children? 349 children, adolescents about age 1 to 17, 69% accompanied by their parent. No statistically different change in calories before or after labeling. 35% ate fast food six or more times per week. 57% said they noticed the calorie labels. Only 9% used them to order. 72% said taste was the most important factor in their meal selection. Indeed. How about strategies that might work? How about controls on advertising and marketing? We've been talking about this advertising to children forever, okay? The Olympics is a perfect example of the disaster. Okay? Counter-advertising campaigns, like, for instance, the New York City Department of Health. Anybody ever see the YouTube video, Man Drinking Fat? It's fantastic. It's wonderful. It's great. And you know what? It doesn't work. Okay? It's wonderful and it doesn't work. How about industry self-regulation? So in Istanbul in 2007, 52 European health ministers got together and said, yes, they would vote to cease marketing of junk foods to children. In 2007, I approached the Federal Communications Commissioner, Deborah Taylor Tate, under the Bush administration, and asked her this question, would the United States consider this? And she said, I expect the food industry to police itself, and that is still true today. The Corn Refiners Association rebranded high fructose corn syrup as corn sugar without FDA approval, and they're still selling it as such. So, industry self-regulation, they won't even go with the regulations they got. Santa Clara and San Francisco, the toy ban on Happy Meals. And I am proud to say that I was part of that movement, and I continue to be proud of it. Because children don't need any more coercion than they've already got to eat a fast food meal. However, since that toy ban, three states have instituted bans on toy bans. And finally, the campaign to retire Ronald, which continues ongoing. How about strategies that are likely to work? Okay, pricing strategies always work, sadly. Controls at the point of sales, bundling strategies, and ultimately government agency action. So here we get into the taxing. Bottom line is, this isn't very new. Canada and Europe already do this with their general sales tax and value-added tax. Price elasticity on a can of soda is so huge, it is so enormous, that a 10% increase in price only reduces consumption by 2%. That means you gotta raise the bar really high. Roland Stern, down here at the bottom, showed that you have to double the price of a can of soda to reduce consumption significantly. That's a problem. Okay? The other problem is, no one trusts government. God knows, I don't trust them. Okay? So, are they gonna generate money for programs to help the obese, or to underwrite farmers markets in local, you know, poor areas? Or are they just gonna do a money grab and use the money for their own purposes, like so many times? And that's the reason the libertarians are so inflamed by this, is because they consider this a money grab. And indeed, the way government currently operates, they're right. But the bottom line is, we still need a public health strategy that works. So let's debate it. Let's have an argument about it that's real, rather than blogging about it in the blogosphere. This is similar to what we saw with tobacco and alcohol. There's really no difference. About differential subsidization, could we tax the bad food and actually underwrite the healthy food? So could we modify behavior through pricing? The answer is absolutely yes. In fact, Andreas Infeld is here. The Nordic countries have state-run liquor stores, and the price of all the alcohol is exactly the same. And they charge less for the low alcohol beer than for the high alcohol spirits, specifically to reduce alcohol-related health harms, which they have shown both in terms of cirrhosis and in terms of car accidents. So they have a policy that actually works, and I'm for them. Okay? We could discount diet soda to make that more palatable and tax regular soda to get the fructose consumption down. Now, I'm not for diet soda. None of you should be for diet soda, but you know what? It's kind of like methadone is to morphine, you know? It's a way of getting off the stuff. You could wean it down if you had to. Ultimately, this is the bottom line, the iron law of alcohol policy. This is absolutely airtight and truly iron. Reducing the availability of alcohol will reduce alcohol consumption, thereby reducing alcohol-related health harm. Same thing would be true for sugar. Could we restrict? How about age limits on purchase and use? Like, for instance, carding kids for Coke, okay? I mean, do you want your kid to go into a convenience store after school to buy a Coke? Do you want them to do that? There's a posse of mothers in South Philadelphia who actually barricaded the entrance to the convenience store outside the school to make sure their kids didn't do that. I so applaud them. The point is, why should they have to do that? Why can't a public health directive do that? How about licensing and zoning controls on sales outlets? Okay, there are 2.5 fast food restaurants per 1,000 square meters in lower socioeconomic neighborhoods versus 1.5 in affluent neighborhoods. How about permits that control hours of operation? How about we just don't sell soda between 7 and 9 in the morning and 3 and 5 in the afternoon, okay? Or if a parent wants their kid to have a Coke, let them go buy it for them, okay? I guarantee you they wouldn't. In California, we have something called Sodas Out of Schools, SB 19. The last survey in 2010 showed that school obesity rates were stable. We think this may be why. And ultimately, Michael Bloomberg's Big Gulp ban. Whatever you want to say about it, nobody needs a 32-ounce Big Gulp, okay? Hydration, screw you. But the problem is, if you just do it in schools, it's a problem, because here we're looking at purchasing in the center, okay? And we're looking at 5th grade and 8th grade banning soda only or all sugar beverages. If you ban soda, you still have just as much consumption because you get it at home. So doing something in schools isn't enough. We have to do it across the board. Another reason for public health intervention. And finally, government agency and action. Now, there's no way in the world Congress is going to regulate the food industry, because they're bought off, because 6% of our exports are food. $56 billion riding on this. And if we tell the whole world, you know what? The Western diet, it ain't really so good for you. What do you think would happen? What happened when that one downer cow went from Canada to Washington State back in 2003? That was the end of meat sales to Britain and South Korea for 2 years. Bottom line, the USDA's job is to protect the food supply. And that includes protecting it from people like me and people like you. That's a problem. Why can't the Farm Bill subsidize real food instead of food ingredients? It could. You know, the Farm Bill was set up because of the Dust Bowl. Okay, so we needed commodities. Commodities means storable food, food that wouldn't go bad. Okay, like Joseph and Pharaoh. Okay, you know, the 7 years of famine, right? They stored grain, because you can store grain. Bottom line is, we could store real food now because we have the technology to do it. Okay, we choose not to, but we need to. The USDA does not have a dietary reference intake for sugar. Why not? Because they don't want you to know that you need to limit your sugar consumption. And finally, food stamps. Bloomberg tried to get food stamps off the USDA list, right? He was rebuffed, right? Several states have since applied. Why is the USDA in charge anyway? That's like the fox in charge of the henhouse. Do they have anything to do with our health? But the FDA and the European Food Safety Administration could influence the court of public opinion if they wanted to. They could make sugar less appealing. You know, cigarettes went from fashion to filthy habit in just a few years.